The Armadale had five of us, five apprentices. You can see us all in this photograph. There's Foster, right in the middle at the back. You see him? Harold Luke Foster. That's what it says where the apprentices are listed on the agreement. But to us, he was Foss. Next but one to him is Rangdale, a Yorkshire lad known as Geordie. This was his first voyage, and more than once, we wondered if it would be his last. Armadale made some fast passages, but her North Atlantic crossing in June 1901 wasn't one of them, even though it was summer. We were 36 days out of London before we made it to the port of New York. That was enough to give Geordie his sea legs, and it might well have been that that's what turned the old man's hair grey. The owners were keen to see the delivery of her cargo, and Captain Stevens, he probably spent much of that passage anticipating quite a cool reception at their agent's office in New York. On the next leg, New York to Melbourne, there were times when we did really make speed. Some days we covered more than 240 miles. No records broken, mind you, although 2 months out, we were in Australia. But it was Geordie I was talking about, wasn't it? He was the youngest on board, and he was only 15. So, 40 years separated him from the captain. What a change in shipping over these decades. The old man had first gone to sea when sailing ships were at their peak. By the early 20th century, you had to look hard for employers who hadn't given up on sail. The Roxburghs, owners of the ship Armadale, were one. They were a Glasgow-based company with 9 vessels all told, but just one steamship. Having 8 in sail in 1900 really made them unusual. But, provided a scheduled delivery wasn't important, these vessels, they still shifted cargo at some profit. The time of the Boer War meant that there was a demand for shipping, so freights were high and there were some pickings to be made by the sailing ship owners. In New York, when this picture was taken, we were loading general cargo, and don't I know it, and well remember it. My job as one of the senior apprentices was to count it all into her hold. Every bundle of iron, barrel of resin, piece of lumber, roll of paper and box of clothespins had to be tallied and checked off against the cargo manifest. Of course, we were put to do the work, which, if it had been done by the regular crew, would have meant extra pay. As apprentices, we only got our board and lodgings and the occasional dollar to spend. I guess that it paid the Roxburghs to have apprentices, because the premiums our families paid went into the company's revenues. Our people considered a few years in sail as an investment. You see, we couldn't qualify as a master without it, and working with a good sailing ship concern was a fine way to get the necessary experience. For some of us, it meant a leg up on the ladder of the steamliner companies who offered the best-paying master's jobs. Cargo checking was Joe's job too. That's Henry Jones. He's standing first left in the picture there. He was my sidekick. His indentures were made in Glasgow, 6 months after mine, but for a shorter term. And which of these brass bounders am I? I've still not even introduced myself properly, but I am Alexander Stuart Mackay. That's me with the moustache and the peat cap, standing third from the left. Okay, Foz, Geordie, Joe and me. That makes only 4 apprentices. There's no Joseph Stevenson. Perhaps he was below deck again, for Jim, as we knew him, was often sick. He'd been sent to sea for the sake of his health. If only his doting family had seen where that would lead, to the outbacks of Australia. But I was sure the photographer had all of us when he lined up the crew on the deck in the Erin Basin in Brooklyn. That was his business, taking photographs of ships and crews when they arrived in port. He came back later with copies to sell, and some of the crew actually posted them home before our ship sailed. The one you're looking at here went to my sister Maggie in Edinburgh. Post haste, right away, she wrote me a letter telling me how pleased she was to have it, but her reply missed us in New York, and it wasn't delivered until the boat came out when we anchored off Melbourne. That was in January 1902. We were disappointed at not making our destination before Christmas. However, still, there was a New Year bundle of letters awaiting, 6 of them just for me. Everything we got, we kept to be read and reread. That's what seamen call taking sailor's pleasure. We apprentices didn't muck in with the rest of the crew. Our closest relationship wasn't with the officers either, and certainly not with the master, who kept a stern watch over us, especially at our lessons in navigation. No, it was the cook. That cook, he was a Cockney, and he stayed with Armadale right back to Britain. So we got to know pretty well how far we could go with our wheezes for extra victuals. When birthday time came for the apprentices, it was held in the forecastle, and it was always a good excuse for a pudding duff. We made it ourselves, and sometimes with results that the cook must have thought wasteful of the contents of his store cupboard. After several weeks at sea, provisions were then doled out pretty carefully. But that isn't a full crew that you're looking at in this photograph. The Armadale was over 2,000 tons, and a ship that size carried a large area of sail. If you go back to Captain Stevens' early years, and you would have found many vessels of just 200 tons on the North Atlantic. It's true, there were some steel-hulled sailing vessels twice her size afloat in the early 1900s. Yet Armadale was built big, and it was built to go far. A barque of 2,000 tons was no small tiddler. She paid her way, running between Europe, North America, and Australia. But wasn't I on my way to a point about the handling of this sail? She had gear to assist, reefing gear, such as the old man would only have dreamed of in his early vessels. Yet, with 13 ABs from New York to Melbourne, the Armadale was a bit, you know, a tad undermanned. She had carried 15 able-bodied and one ordinary seaman on the first leg, and on the return voyage from Australia, she had 16 ABs. Armadale wasn't the easiest ship to handle. Now, just a few months on from this picture, I had even more reason to know it. Like, when my apprenticeship expired in Melbourne, I was signed on to the crew as the third mate. So I made the four-month journey back to England at a whole new level of responsibility, third mate. But to return to New York, many of the ABs and the OS had cleared off before this photograph was taken. It was no surprise to see them jump ship, quit the ship. America paid better wages, and there were well-paid jobs on merchant vessels. Before the boom turned to bust at the end of 1901, there were ships looking for men in the port of New York, and work was also available ashore. These deserters, they were canny enough not to have any pay from the Armadale outstanding when they left. For, despite the unexpected length of the first leg of her outward passage, a month's advance had been given all of them in London. Some tobacco or slops from the master's chest would have compensated for the additional 6 days' pay forfeited when they'd jumped ship. The New York crimps were pretty assiduous in getting them ashore. I wonder how many would have remained if we'd not been besieged as soon as we took tow from the tug bringing us up the river. I'll never forget how they swarmed onto the vessel once we were alongside the wharf. They came with bottles of chain lightning. 11 of the seamen went at the first opportunity. One who stayed at least long enough to be in this photograph was the Chilean AB sitting to the left there. We knew him as Phillips, though I see he's Santiago Toro on the agreement. Maybe fixing up a job in New York took him longer than the European and the British-born men. Or was he trying to find a vessel heading to the west coast of South America? In any case, a week later he picked up his bags and left. Of the few ABs who stayed with the ship, there was a Scandinavian, Lindholm, standing second left. Now, he went all the way back to England, as did the youngsters. Moore, sitting second left, Volkmar, holding the lifebelt with Moore, and Astrom, sitting far right. Most of the petty officers were with the ship for the entire voyage, although I do recall we had trouble getting and keeping a carpenter. Our first guy jumped ship a week after turning out for this group photograph. His replacement didn't join when we left in August, although he'd signed and he'd taken £6 advance in wages. So that left us with Carlson, a Finn, engaged in New York as an AB, to be officially made up to the position on the return run from Melbourne. We suffered one casualty, the steward, but the sickness rather than accident. While there were plenty of knocks and cuts and bruises, there was just this one fatality. He's standing fourth from the right in the photograph. We buried him at sea. At 59, Antoine Haas was the oldest on board, but my fellow apprentice Jim had been ailing on that voyage too. And although he'd finished his time before we arrived in Melbourne, the old man let him know that he didn't think him fit enough to return. So Jim took off with a letter of introduction to a fruit farmer who had a place over 160 miles inland from Melbourne. It was hot and dusty there, he wrote. Now that was a letter to read several weeks later when we rounded the horn and when my room was like an iceberg. Yeah, I stayed with the Armadale. You remember, the master had made me up to third mate. And never before had that ship seen a third mate like me. Joe's indentures were finished too, but he took leave of us and shipped back on another vessel, the Albine, which was destined to go around the coast to Newcastle. That vessel had beaten us in the outward passage from New York. Meanwhile, the Armadale received orders for Hull. We arrived there on 15th July 1902, 13 months after our departure from England. I lost no time getting back to Scotland, but it wasn't just that I wanted to see Maggie and the others in Edinburgh. Although I was no longer an apprentice, there would be nothing for me beyond third mate until I was certificated. Being back in Auld Reekie meant I could put in some study time there. Sure enough, Captain Stevens had provided practice in navigation, but book learning with an instructor on shore made the difference. Within 2 weeks of my return, I passed the exams for second mate. There were further exams to qualify as first mate and then as master, but more sea time was necessary. Still, 6 years later, I held not just a master's certificate, but an extra master's. Those were difficult years in shipping between 1902 and 1908. There was much tonnage chasing too few cargoes. Yet somehow I kept myself fully employed. In 1902, it was the Roxburghs who took me on again, this time for the Torres deal. I joined her at Cardiff, and 6 weeks after I departed on the Armadale, I was setting off again, this time for Algoa Bay, with Black Diamonds as the outward cargo. These sailing vessels were fine ones, but the future was clear. If you could see my record at Lloyd's, it would show you that by 1914 I was with the Royal Mail Steam Packet Company, working on their mail and passenger steamers. Mind you, I had to start out as second mate. There were just too many men with extra masters looking for junior officers' positions with the RMSB, and with every other liner company for that matter. Only after the war and experience in North Atlantic convoys did the RMSB fully trust me with a command. She was the Conway, and the West Indies was her destination. By then, rounding the horn in a foremaster was already a fading experience, but it was there, for sure, that I got a taste for the sea, a love for the sea, and the salt water. Windbag fever had never left me.